Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 Joycast. In this Joycast, you'll hear a summary of the weekly program. Due to copyright restrictions, the music has been edited to make this Joycast possible. For more information about the music played during the show, please visit the blog at joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera.
Good evening and welcome to another episode of The Fool and the Opera. Thanks very much for joining me. It's Dan Vo here, and of course, as you know by now, I am The Fool. And today I really will be playing that up because I've got some two very talented guests today, and very educated guests in terms of opera. I've got Karen Michelle Lyon, which I love to say in the French way because it sounds so beautiful. But Karen Lyon, who's a soprano and a student at the Melbourne Opera School, and she will be taking over the role of Pamida, coming up with the Magic Flute. So we'll be talking with her about her role, but we've also got the artistic director of the company as well, and Lynn Thompson will be here to help us dissect and sort of examine the intricacies of a particular Mozart aria, which we'll be looking at in depth today, which is Pamina's aria, which is Ach, ich fühl's, es ist verschwunden. That's my attempt at German. We'll see how the rest of the show goes, and the theme for today is going to be Trial by Aria, Musical Examination, and Red Lanterns. That's going to be an interesting one because we'll be having a little bit of Cambodian and also Chinese opera a little bit later in the show as well. So we'll see how all that fits together. So I'm sure you'll be in your seat riveted. Now, as you know, I always like to start the show with a bit of a quirky track. And today we've got one from Michael Nyman because he was in town recently. And this one is a Mozart as well. And with his music, this is sort of the start of Michael Nyman's style, this particular track. And it was for the draftsman's contract. And last week we played Madamina, the catalogue aria from Mozart's Don Giovanni. So it's got a bit of a Mozart-esque connection here. And the style that Michael Nyman has chosen for this was to play it in a 50s rocker Jerry Lee Lewis style. So you can say that Mozart's aria took a whole lot of shaking, which is a Jerry Lee Lewis joke there, which I don't quite get myself, but I'm sure those of us who understand it will get it. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9, and my guests today are Linda Thompson, the Artistic Director of Opera School Melbourne, and Carrie Lyon, who is going to be performing as Pamina in The Magic Flute. There's a production coming up this week.
That's right.
So thanks for joining me.
Pleasure, thank you.
So I understand that you've been rehearsing all day, which is quite an arduous thing to be coming here after a big rehearsal.
Well, this morning wasn't quite rehearsal. We actually took a bit of a risk and went and sang in the city square for a few hours.
Oh, really?
Yes, it was really fun, extremely cold, but it was great. It was really, really fun thing to do. And then we had our first orchestral rehearsal this afternoon.
So was it a bit of The Magic Flute in the city?
That's right.
How did you go with that, Karen? How did it feel to be performing?
Actually, it was really fun. We had a whole lot of people just stopping in the street to listen to it and crossing the street to come and see what we were doing, and hopefully some of them will come and see our show.
That's one of the most amazing things I love about having street performance in the city, which is you just set up and you start performing and people just will stop, and then they kind of get this like glazed look on their face. They kind of go, oh, this is beautiful music.
Mm.
And it's just something that they didn't expect in their day. So I think it's a lovely little gift.
We had tears as well this morning. We had tears and children who'd never heard
it's really opera exciting before. When it's small children. We had a little boy who was about three, got a stick and decided to conduct. That was the highlight for me. I'm so cute.
In fact, we just decided that it was too cold and it looked like it was going to rain. There was a little bit of rain. We decided to pack up and all of a sudden we did our last number and we just got a horde of people, so we stayed for another 40 minutes or something after that, which was great.
Lovely. Yeah. So it would have been the magic flute out in the open with the real weather. So
yes.
Now, we've got a version of... We're going to talk a little bit about Pamina's aria today. And Karen, do you want to tell us a little bit about what the aria is about? And the proper way to pronounce it as well in German would be lovely.
It's Archifus. We're actually going to sing it in English, so it's much more accessible for our audience. But basically, at this point, Tamino's... Pamina's love has been forbidden to speak to her. He's proving his worth in the temple. And so she comes in and he won't speak to her. So she turns and she sings this aria about how if he no longer loves her, then she can only find peace in death.
So with this particular aria, now you mentioned that you'll be singing it in English. And
yes.
Of course, the version we've got here is in German. There's a few different versions of it, I suppose, sort of in English, and isn't there? Because, I went to cut up a piece so that we can examine it, and the words are completely different. So how do we get all these different sort of variations of the same piece?
Well, I think with translation, there's a certain amount of liberty that's always taken in terms of what one word means to someone means something to somebody else. The other thing that happens is that through convention, singers will sing whatever vowels and words suit themselves. So we end up with, a version that we start with and then a performing version at the end. And so that's what we've ended up with is a collaboration to find the best use of the English that we like.
So what's the version that we do have here that
you'll
be looking at?
Well, this is the Schirmer edition.
In essence, yes.
In essence, yes.
Okay, so, and you've got the German alongside the English as well. And
we do.
I've got a photocopy of the what do you call it? The the music with the sticks and where you
sheet
put,
music.
Thank you.
The score.
Thank you. And we'll be posting up little bits of it online as well, so you can have a look at what it looks like as well. Because this is the first time I've actually had a look at, I suppose, music where you've got this is I suppose for piano accompaniment.
Yes,
the version
this is
that we've
a
got.
Piano reduction here.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll post it up as well, so people kind of have a look as well. So we'll put that up on the blog a little bit after the show. You can check it out on joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera. So I'm going to play the entire aria now, and then we'll come back and we'll start dissecting it.
Good fun.
Should be fun. All right, you're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. There's the most exquisite music, I think, from the Magic Flute there, by Mozart, of course. And my guests today are Carrie Leon from the Opera School Melbourne and Linda Thompson, who's the Artistic Director. Thank you for joining me.
Pleasure.
Now, you were commenting on that particular aria, because I didn't know who it was who sang, and so we're trying to play the guessing game during the song as well to guess who it was. And some of the things I heard you saying was it's an edgier version, it's a little bit rawer. I find that very interesting. Do you want to comment on what you thought of the aria?
Well, more that the voice was quite... From modern-day recordings, the voice type was quite warm and heavy, and such was the convention in the 1970s when that was probably recorded, I hazard a guess. I'm not sure. But that's when she would have been towards the end of her career. Under
okay.
Leonovitz we're talking about. Yeah, so it's a very warm, rich sound. And Pamina these days is often sung by a more soubrette sound because I think the directors go for... Often the soubrettes are very small and they fit that sort of doll-like look.
Okay.
And the voice goes with it.
So what does it mean to have a soubrette sound?
Is just it a silvery, sort of smaller, thinner sound. Yeah, I mean, the days of only singing in a particular, what's called a German Fach, is still very much alive and well in Germany, but increasingly across the world people are crossing Fachs and repertoire according to what the record producer... I know, F-A-C-H. and basically, if people get asked to sing something, if they can sing the notes, they sing it. So it's not so straight, certainly in America and Australia, for that matter. There's a lot more flexibility.
Kerry, how would you describe your voice? I understand there's different sort of categories of soprano, isn't there?
Yeah, so I'm a lyric, but lighter end of lyric at the moment.
Okay, so that's why your voice is suited to this particular aria, as we kind of do it now, where it's lighter, because it's got... Is it harder to sing sort of in that particular aria? There's the high notes, that goes up very high, and then there's the extended notes where it's held for a long time. What do you think's harder in terms of for you?
For me, the height has always come very easily.
Okay.
So for me, it's those few arpeggios where it goes up from the lower end of the voice is always the bit that I suppose I've been told to work on and been working on the last few weeks in preparing the role.
Okay. Well, I think what we'll do now is we might go through and just play little bits of the music back again and sort of just analyse it from piece to piece and sort of look at it from the perspective of how you approached certain parts of the particular aria. And we might even just have a look at, you know, the different structures, like, you know, whether what key it's in, why it's in that key, sure, and that sort of stuff. So we'll have a bit of fun. So we'll just play a little bit of music and we'll comment on it as we go. So this is just the first part. So that's the first section, and we've just got a little bit of music there going. So there's a nice little translation on the score or the sheet music that you provided. So, I feel to grief and sadness, ever turned is love's delight. And I think it continues for a little bit more. So ever turned is love's delight. So there's a bit of repetition there, which I think Mozart is quite well known for.
Yes. Repetition. Maybe just intensifying by...
A lot of arias, we tend to say things twice, but in a different way. So,
let's start with the music itself. There's this sort of pulsing strings that starts underneath, and it plays twice, and it feels almost like a heartbeat. For you, as a and it is about grief and all that sort of stuff. It's about love and grief and Pamina's mourning, you know, the loss of Tamino. Do you feel that coming through as well? Like, how do you approach it? Do you take that and use it?
Yeah, for me, the heartbeat is exactly right. It's G minor. It's a very heavy chord, and it sort of grounds you into that feeling of she's gone from, in two lines in the dialogue before, from being absolutely ecstatic to find him to just being desolate and going on through the aria to become suicidal. So,
and actually, G minor was Mozart's. It was considered his most appropriate key for tragedy and devastation. So
it's very interesting, isn't it, that it creates that feel just by the minor addition. Is the G minor throughout the entire aria? Does it change at any point?
Oh, I mean, different tonalities are introduced, but the overwhelming feeling of it is G minor.
Okay, all right. Well, let's follow along with the next section and we'll see how the rest of it goes. There's the repeat. How does that? Is that something that's written into the music, or is it something that you, as a performer, interpret yourself?
It varies, but in this music, obviously, it is written in. It goes from being the first time they say it, it's quite low and ornamented, and the second time really high in the tessitura. And obviously, it's a sigh of desperation for me going up to the B flat, which is the highest note in this piece.
Do you have the right to kind of emphasize different parts as you go along, or is that something that is forbidden in music?
Oh, that varies. There are people who think that you do what's written in the score and only what's written in the score, and Mozart has written it in such a way that it will work for you. But, you know, by singing it, you are doing something artistic and you can't help but put your own emphasis on certain words or certain things that, or certain figures, musical phrases that mean something to you. The most difficult thing about the beginning of this aria, though, is the amount of composure that you have to have, because if you go with the full devastation of it right from the beginning, then it becomes impossible to sing. So you've got to have this sort of incredible calm and find a certain determination to just be really accurate and be ready to expose your emotional vulnerability, but without going too far that it becomes quite mad to sing.
Is that the case, Karen? Are you kind of reining in your emotions at the start of this aria? Is that how you feel?
Yeah, I think so. And as you get through to the section with the semiquavers and then the demi-semiquavers, you can let it go a bit more.
You're going to have to point out that section when it comes up, because I'm not going to know how to pick demi-semiquavers. But all right, let's go to the next section and we'll have a little bit more listen. So that section, we've got Gone Forever, Joy and Gladness, In My Heart Reigns Mournful Night. Now, with that, we've got a flute and an oboe sort of cutting in, and it almost feels like a call and response. They kind of hit a particular note, and you're matching it?
Have you thought about it that way?
No, actually.
I've actually thought about it more in terms of the staging of it,
okay.
And that is a moment where Tamino might go to respond and realise he can't. And so I've always thought of those elements as being part of what's going on stage rather than what's going on with Pamina. Because I feel like her thoughts are just all on disbelief, and she's actually in a state of shock. Whereas, so the more, those more surprising elements, I like to think of them more theatrically.
Okay, so the sound of the flute, is that what you mean by it's Tamino?
Well, it's Tamino's flute, yes. So not that he necessarily plays it, but every time the flute is played in the Magic Flute, it does represent him and his struggle and his love and his magic. So I think even in this, we almost get a sense of, or he might speak, and then she comes back in with that, nevermore will that hour happen again, my love is gone, comes back.
One of the things that's interesting about the Magic Flute is a lot of musicologists have said that Mozart wrote it, and he wrote it below his own talent level. And in a way that he was kind of like just appealing to the masses or the audiences of Vienna. He was just sort of, you know, watering it down so that it was entertaining to them. Do you kind of get that feeling that, because when you're saying that, you know, all these little things mean this and that, it doesn't feel like Mozart watered it down?
Yeah, I'm not a Mozart scholar, but I don't subscribe to that, because the music is extraordinary and there's nothing sort of lesser quality in this music. I think perhaps it's the introduction of the comic dialogue might have brought it down to please the masses, and certainly in Mozart's day, if they enjoyed an aria and applauded loudly enough, it would be repeated, and I think that happened, by all accounts, it happened constantly in this piece. People wanted to hear the same arias over and over again.
He did write it for a popular theatre. It wasn't written... It was written basically for a combination of amazing singers and comic actors, who one of whom actually helped out with the libretto. Mm.
And Shikineta, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And with Pamina, the interesting thing between, I suppose, Mozart and Shikineta was he kind of just wrote her as, you know, she'd be the reward at the end for Tamino, but Mozart kind of wrote her in as something more of, you actually have a journey musically via Mozart, don't you? You kind of start off with you just being this naive girl, and then by the end of it, towards this aria, you become a fully fledged woman.
Well, it was originally written for a 17-year-old, And I think that naivety is really important to find, even though the music itself is so, I mean, particularly when we get into the second act and you know, when she's actually threatening to kill herself with a dagger, we're getting into really some heavy, heavy themes. But at the same time, you can see that it's an adolescent brain that sort of goes with, my boyfriend won't speak to me, so I'm going to kill myself.
Kerry, how have you approached the role? How have you kind of tackled Pamina?
Well, Pamina was actually my first role when I was 21. So every time I've come back to it, it's slightly different. And I think this time, because we're doing it in a shortened version, and so we've taken out certain sections, the aria becomes a lot more central, as does the suicide quartet at the end. And so I think she's a lot more angsty in our version. She's a lot more down that
she's
teenage
an emo Pamina
kind of path.
Has your readings developed? Have you kind of given her different aspects as you yourself have kind of picked up different experiences? Like, do you draw on your own experiences as a singer to put into the character?
Definitely. And I think every time I've come back to it, I've been in a different place personally, and it does colour the way you sing it and the way that you just colour your voice into each phrase.
Tell me about colouring the voice. How does that happen? Like, what are you? Is it something you're consciously doing, or is it something that just it happens as the emotion takes you?
It's a combination. If you let the emotion take you altogether, especially in music like this, you're going to get lost. So it's partly conscious, but it's also the emotion and letting the emotion inform the singing without actually giving over to it,
taking
as Linda
over.
Was saying to it before.
Well, I think it's really important in rehearsal, though, to go as far as you can and, you know, even to the point of crying so that you realise how far you can go. But, of course, you can't sing when you cry, so you have to pull back a little bit. But there's a colour that you discover from getting to that point that feels right, and I think that's what the rehearsal process is about, taking things emotionally and artistically as far as you can go and then realising what works when you put it into context and on stage.
Okay, all right, well, let's go into the next section. We're about to go into some pretty heavy up and downs, and talking about emotion, I think it's quite appropriate to keep that in mind when we're listening to this next section. Is that as high as it goes, or does it go a bit higher?
That is as high as it goes.
So what is it about your voice that allows you to reach that height without in trouble? Because it sounds so difficult to me. Like, well, because I'm a boy, but...
actually, you're asking the wrong person, because for me that is the easiest part, is the high notes. I've just always... I think no one told me these things were high when I started singing them. And... Yeah.
Well, I think that's an important part too, because a lot of what we do when we're teaching singing is to address the psychological fear of heights as far as range goes. And it's incredible what you can do if you just think things are lower than they are on the page. So I think there's something in not knowing what notes you're singing.
And really, this is only a B-flat, and the Queen of the Night's going to put out some Fs above that.
Yes, so we're relative
nothing
terms.
To complain about.
It's high for a lyric soprano. B flat is getting to the height of the range. But the way this is written, the difficulty is in the exposure, and the intonation has to be so accurate and quite specifically where he's got, you know, he's got sharpened notes on the way up and flattened on the way down, so that those flattened notes need to, you know, almost sound like teardrops, you know, just falling onto the flattened version of the note. And looking at it musically can bring out that dimension in terms of emotional colour and shape as well, and takes all the attention away from the fact that you're about to go up to a B-flat anyway.
So with the music, and in terms of it being going up, it's sort of got that sharp anguish, and when it comes down, it's got that despair, I suppose, in it. Is that something that... Is that the music sort of referenced elsewhere in the opera as well? Or is this kind of, you know, because that I suppose Pamina has a sort of a V shape, you know, it goes up and down and back up. It's got this very patternistic, I suppose, sound to it. Does it get used again in the opera?
Well, that's sort of based around what's known as a melodic minor scale, so it's used throughout music as we know it everywhere. It's particularly interesting in this little phrase because, and we've had discussions in rehearsal about whether this phrase with all the semiquavers, all the fast notes and all the precise intervals, does it sound flute-like, or could it be, you know, that she's talking about the knife, could it be predicting what she's going to do later on? It's very flute-like in the writing, though. We decided that it was all about the connection to Tamino and the flute and the heart, and that's the way it was written.
And that with the staccato, the short notes towards the end of that phrase, that it's almost like she can't get through it.
She can't breathe.
Oh, wow, that's quite amazing. Shall we go into the next section? So that's exactly what you're talking about just there. We've got see Tamino, see my anguish, see my tears for you, my own. Ah, you, my own, for love you do not languish, you do not languish. How would you describe this section in terms of musically and aligning that with the words that are coming through?
This is more of a dialogue, trying to get Tamino to speak and basically offering him, by the shortening the phrases and repeating them, is pleading and offering him a chance to respond, and I think it's her last effort before she decides that it's useless. And so we do get moments of hope in the ascending phrases of the flute each time before she says, "See, Tamino, and look at my tears," and it's, "Please say something, please say something." He just doesn't.
We'll play the next section very quickly as well.
So for that section, we're actually singing, "All my heart will long for death alone. Just a word to say you love me, all my heart will long for death alone."
It's some pretty amazing stuff. And I don't know if Mozart was away from his wife at the time. Constance was back, you know, not in Vienna. I wonder if some of the stuff, you know, I wonder if the things that he had happening in his life kind of helped him with the music, helped him along with the music. In the same way that I suppose your own experiences are able to go into the music as well.
Oh, I'm sure that was the case, and certainly from reading, Constance wasn't constant by any stretch of the imagination. There were rumours that she was fooling around with somebody while she was away, so I think that did inform.
Oh, that's amazing. I didn't know that.
So I think that Pamina, being a 17-year-old. Naive girl, I think that we don't need to worry about that in a sense of finding the heart of Pamina, because I think we just look for the most simplistic and the most intense form of the emotion, and it's all here. And seriously, she thinks that the turmoil from her boyfriend not speaking to her will be soothed and she'll find peace in death, and she firmly believes that. So that's not complicated, and I think that's what the accompaniment of the orchestral accompaniment of the aria tells us too. It's not complicated. It's very clear. There is no choice. He will not speak.
Let's play the next section as well.
Ooh.
almost there. Karen, what's going through your mind at that particular point in the aria? Are you kind of going, I've got through that? Is that what's going through your head?
Yeah, a little bit. No. By that point in the aria, for me, I think you can give over to the emotion of it a bit and just do what feels right. I don't really think about it that much by that point.
That's interesting. So when you're on stage, do you have sort of, you're just in the music, you don't have an active part of your brain that's kind of going, I wonder, if I've left the kettle on at home or something. Like, is there another part of your brain that kind of is actively thinking, or is it just completely just the music?
It has to be there, but I think that part is so much in rehearsal that really by the time you get on the stage, you should be able to just do it. And there are certain moments where you have to be aware of the conductor, you have to be aware of the orchestra or the vocal demands or whatever. But for the most part, you should be able to really focus on the character and being that character so that the audience can believe your story.
How important is it for a story, I suppose, where it would seem slightly strange to audiences these days, a serpent comes out and there's all these, natural beings coming out. How hard is it to create something that is believable for an audience?
Well, I don't know why people have a problem with that sort of thing. When you think about the supernatural films and the FX films, I mean, all those things that people accept on film that they somehow struggle with in opera. I guess our production is really geared towards trying to create a clear story and a clear narrative. So Tamino is actually having a birthday party at the beginning, and so this is his dream. And so because we have limited forces, we have people coming and going, and so 1 minute someone's there, the next minute they're back, and it's people coming and going. But what we've tried to do is find the truth of the relationship between Tamino and Pamina, and focus on the elements of love and fantasy and magic, as opposed to the Freemasonry and the seriousness of the trials and things, which is obviously a big part of the full opera. We've made a few adjustments to suit the forces that we have, and think that we've got a really clear, moving but believable story, because it is a dream after all.
Mm. Now, in this particular production as well, there's an orchestra of 15, so it's a different adaptation, I suppose, of...
Well, it's not...
Arrangement, sorry.
Yeah. It's a specific arrangement by an amazing UK composer called Jonathan Dove, who's having remarkable success with his own composition now, but I'm not sure how long ago he did this arrangement for Birmingham Opera, and it's really interesting because it doesn't sound like someone's taken the orchestra and reduced it. It sounds like somebody's actually thought about what it's going to sound like at the end, so I don't think anyone will miss anything. Mm. It's really interesting.
Kerry, with this particular performance then, with a smaller orchestra, has it been possible for you to be more subtle and nuanced in your performance? In a way that you may not be with a 100 or so orchestra?
No, I think that actually it goes with the conductor. And so long as they know what you're trying to do and they are on the same page, I guess, with your interpretation, the nuances and the subtlety, everything can be there in whichever form. Certainly it's really beautiful having the smaller ensemble. It's a really nice colour in the sound, and it's been lovely today, just this afternoon, we've been singing with them. And it's so beautiful to sing with an orchestra, because you do get just so much more from that than you ever could from a piano. So.
Well, the heartbeats, for example, the heartbeats on strings are just not the same on piano. Well, I've probably offended lots of pianists. But when this aria starts and it's just, the tugging of the heartstrings, that's exactly what it is, and it's quite beautiful.
Well, in this last section, I think I love it. It's just gorgeous. There's a bit of repetition, as we said, Mozart's known for it, but it also, the orchestra, the strings, they just completely break free, and there's a beautiful, passionate, and I suppose they're just showing compassion for what Pamina's just sung. So this is the final part. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. And my guests today have been Karen Michelle Leon and also Linda Thompson. And thank you for joining me to talk about the Magic Flute. It's been an interesting experiment.
I've enjoyed it.
Now, the production will be coming to the National Theatre, which is a beautiful... she's a great old girl, the National Theatre.
Oh, it is. It's lovely. It's lovely. And in fact, the first opera school started at the National Theatre, not that particular building, but certainly the National Theatre movement in 1936. So we have a bit of a connection there as well.
Mm, it's a lovely little connection. It's like coming back home, I suppose.
And actually, Gertrude Johnson was one of the most applauded Queen of the Knights at Covent Garden. So a bit of symbolism there with the Magic Flute being our first thing, a dedication to Gertrude Johnson.
Oh, lovely. So it's certainly worth going now. It's, of course, on Thursday. There's a matinee and a night performance on Saturday night as well.
That's so right, the 6th and the 8th of August.
I'll definitely post up the details on the blog so you can come along and book and go and see Carrie perform as Pamina, which will be very exciting, I think. Are you excited about the performance?
We can't
coming
wait.
Back?
It's the Opera School's first main stage production, so we're really excited.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me in the studio today.
Pleasure.
Now, as a gift, I thought I'd play some Cambodian music for you, which is interesting. Now, this particular version of it's called Pamina Devi, and it's done by a Cambodian choreographer who basically used the story of Pamina's journey as the basis for telling a story of her own identity struggle and her own struggle with darkness against the Khmer Rouge. So some very amazing music. So I'm going to play that as the parting gift. So thank you for joining me in the studio.
Thank you.
You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. That's a very interesting piece there. It's called Pamina Devi, and it's by Sir Philan Krem Sapiro. And as I said before, that was part of the... and, of course, she was accompanied by the Khmer Arts Ensemble. And it's a very interesting piece of music there. The story is derived from the Magic Flute, and particularly the story of Pamina, which is very unique. And, of course, that was done as part of the 2006 celebrations for Mozart's 250th birthday. So it's quite interesting how people can take existing things and establish things that we presume to know and then completely turn it into something that is unique, new, and incredibly beautiful as well. So that, of course, is Pamina Devi. And I'm going to keep us in Asia for a little bit, and I'm going to take us a little bit further north. And this week, also opening on Wednesday, is going to be a beautiful, speaking of things that, you know, you can take and turn into something new. The book was Raise the Red Lantern by Tu Song, and the movie was Raise the Red Lantern, as directed by Zhang Yimou, and the ballet, which has elements of Chinese opera in it as well, is also directed by Zhang Yimou, and it's coming to Melbourne this week as well, so it's definitely something worth checking out. And I've got 3 double passes to give away for it as well, so if you'd like to come along to this sensational production, check out you can give us a call, 96992949. Jerry's on the desk there and he's ready to take your call, so there's 3 double passes to go. 96992949 is the number, and I'm going to play you just an excerpt of some of the Chinese opera music in it, and you can check out the full-length interview as well with full-length interview regarding this as well on the blog, the podcast, sorry. So I'll post that up, joy.org.au/thefoolandtheopera. So I'll play you a little excerpt. You're on The Fool in the Opera on Joy 94.9, and of course that was the little excerpt from Raise the Red Lantern, which is an amazing book. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend you go out and read it. I haven't seen the film. It's one of the hardest DVDs to get a hold of, but if you've got a copy, you can always let me know. Just let me know via the blog, joy.audio/The Fool in the Opera, and of course you can catch the full interview with Greg Randall from the Art Centre as well, talking about that particular production as well. And I can see Jerry is got his hands full, which means that we've got some winners as well. So thank you so much for listening into the station today and tuning into this particular program. And, of course, thank you so much to my two guests as well, Karen Leon and also Linda Thompson from Opera School Melbourne. And please do go to the blog and check out the two productions that are coming up. So it's really worth checking out. And I'm going to say, as Linda Thompson would say, catch you next week. Same Fledermaus time, same Fledermaus channel. This has been The Fool and the Opera.
Thanks for listening to the Joycast of The Fool and the Opera from Joy 94.9. You can find more Joycasts and the program blog at joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera. The Fool and the Opera is produced by Dan Vo and Jed Gilbert, thanks to the support of Joy sponsors and members. Please help support it by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.